Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of FinTech Mavericks. I'm your host, Nicole Casperson.
And I'm Drew Glover. Nicole, serious question. How are you gearing up for the busy fall ahead?
Honestly, I start by making sure I get rest and relaxation, because if I don't recharge, I am useless by October.
I feel that. But how do you even pull that off with everything that's going on?
That's the trick. You can only really relax if you've put in the prep work beforehand. Clear the schedule, clear the inbox, and set yourself up so you're not carrying chaos into the fall.
And for founders, that prep work isn't just planning. It's making sure your business systems are dialed in.
All right, Mavericks, we've partnered with Brex to give you a financial stack that takes work off your plate so you can head into fall with space to actually think, plan, and breathe.
And we're throwing in some serious perks: Brex travel credits, cash back, AWS, and OpenAI credits, plus white glove onboarding. It's stacked.
Think of it as your FinTech Mavericks back to business package. Time and capital back in your pocket so you can focus on what really matters.
Want all the info? Head to brex.com/FinTech Mavericks so you can learn more about
spending smarter
and moving faster
with Brex.
With Brex.
All right, everyone. Today's guest is someone who turned startup exits into a product and made it cool to talk openly about selling your company. He's the founder and CEO of Acquire.com, which has helped thousands of startups get acquired and facilitated over $500 million in closed deals. Excited to get into all of that. Andrew Gazdecki, welcome to FinTech Mavericks.
Love it. Thank you, Nicole. Appreciate the invite. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for jumping on. So let's start with taking us a little bit back. What's your earliest memory of building something out of necessity?
Well, I've been building stuff really since I was a kid. I knew kind of early I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I'm trying to think of the best story to give you. Here's an embarrassing one. In college, I made a World of Warcraft website where you could buy gold. I didn't really play the game. It was a website where people could, you know, come buy gold. It was an affiliate website. It started making like $50,000 a month. And then it got shut down basically from the pay-per-clicks going too high and the business model fell apart. But I would actually do this thing every summer where I would build a new business. So I built that. I built a real estate marketing tech thing that didn't work out. I built a job board for mobile developers.
How many companies have you built total?
Gosh, in total, maybe like five real ones where I actually like incorporated it. And then before that, I was always tinkering. And I don't know if you remember GeoCities, where you could build a website. It looked like everyone was straight out of the 80s. Yeah, I lived on GeoCities. I used to make websites for all the bands in my high school when I was a freshman. That was a little business. So yeah, stuff like that.
If you could go back, if you go back in time and you had to take one of those businesses that you never incorporated and turn it into a business today, what business would it be?
That's a great question. You know, I had this like reselling company for Beanie Babies. That one actually was doing
That's
pretty
hot.
Good. Yeah, I was kind of just like a young hustler. I just, anything I could get my hands on, sell it. Again, I didn't collect Beanie Babies, but there's a big market. I don't know if you guys remember that, but when Beanie Babies were like big and they had like the Princess Diana doll. I think that one was pretty good. Maybe not.
That's cool.
Actually, I don't know, because they declined.
Oh, yeah. They had an interesting little ticker symbol at one point. And so I think it's fascinating that a number of the businesses that you just laid out, you were like, oh, I didn't play a World of Warcraft. I didn't collect Beanie Babies, but you created businesses around them. Definitely something where it sounds like you did research, that you had people in your life that did do it and you saw like the craze around it. But how are you kind of underwriting these business models back then?
Yeah, that's a good observation. I think, you know, what I've always tried to do is find like trends or waves going on, because it's always easier to ride with a wave than trying to create your own. Like with this company I started in college, it was called Business Apps. It was a mobile app development platform. Same thing. The iPhone just came out. That was a big wave I thought I could ride. But I don't know. That's a really good observation. I never thought of it like that. I always thought like, oh, I sold Beanie Babies as a kid. That's interesting. But I must have just saw a bunch of people buying them, and I thought there was an opportunity there. And then same with the World of Warcraft thing. That one was interesting too, because people would buy like tens of thousands of dollars worth worth of this gold. It was kind of like running a currency exchange.
I mean, you have like a pretty good start button then, right? Because the thing is that people can come up with a bunch of ideas, right? Or be like, oh, that is interesting. Beanie Babies are popular. World of Warcraft, right? This or that. And just come up with the idea, but never do anything with it. But the fact that you were like, I should start something, and then did it, even if it like was a side project or didn't work out or anything like that. But to me, it sounds like you kind of have this like, you have this start button in you that I think most people would really love to have. Any idea where that comes from?
I don't know. You know, I think I've always just been motivated to build something cool. And I think being an entrepreneur, there's also financial benefits as well. I grew up kind of broke. So, you know, when I wanted a skateboard, I had to go get money to buy a skateboard. So I think that was a big motivating factor where I kind of had to figure out ways to make money. I guess I got a start button.
So acquire.com really did also is one of those things that started as a side project. What was the moment that you realized that it could be way bigger?
So Acquire has kind of an interesting story. I had no idea it was going to take off whatsoever. I have this like monthly journal that I write in, just how's business going, what's going right, what's going wrong. And I actually have an entry that says, I don't know if MicroAcquire is going to work out because XYZ, but the website looks really good. You know, that was like the one thing that I made sure to do right. But I would say the moment I knew was probably when the first, you know, acquisitions were taking place, because it's a marketplace. I have to get buyers, I have to get sellers, you have to have quality businesses, you have to have ways for, you know, people to communicate and not feel like they're going to get ripped off. So I think those moments were pretty big. That's when I kind of sat back and said, there's really something here. And then when we started to see two acquisitions a day or three acquisitions a day, when the engine really started moving, I think that's when it became really apparent that this is more than just, you know, a simple marketplace. This is a place that I think could really reshape, you know, entrepreneurs' careers potentially.
Mm-hmm. And for the folks that maybe don't know, tell us a little bit about how Acquire works, right? Like, so you had to end up basically matchmaking, if you will, for acquisitions with startups and buyers. How does the platform actually work?
Yeah, so Acquire.com is the largest online marketplace to buy and sell SaaS businesses, e-commerce, newsletters, content businesses, mobile apps, essentially anything that's, you know, online we can help get acquired. The way it works is you create a listing on the platform. We learn about your business a little bit in terms of how profitable it is. Is it growing? You're able to connect your metrics, whether you're using Stripe or Paddle or Profitwell. Show buyers a true financial picture of your business. And then from there, we connect you with hundreds of thousands of buyers that have specifically said they're interested in these types of businesses. So imagine you're a SaaS founder. You're doing about $500,000 in revenue. You might be too small for a traditional investment bank, or you don't want to work with a traditional advisory firm or broker. You would list with us. And as soon as you go live, you start having NDAs signed with buyers that are specifically interested in that type of business. And that eventually leads to a successful acquisition.
Very cool. I'm curious to like dive in a little bit more into the ICP of both sides of the marketplace. Like, are these buyers simply, are they saying, hey, I want a lifestyle business that I can just like turn cash on? Do they want to take over a CEO? And then I'm curious on the other side, are these just people that are just turning up lovable apps on AI right now, getting to a million in ARR and saying, let's just become a serial builder seller?
Yeah, great questions. We see, you know, kind of the full gamut, but the first bucket that you mentioned, you know, people looking for profitable lifestyle businesses, they want to step into CEO. We see a ton of that. I think that's really, really cool. Where their focus is, you know, on one hand, we have an entrepreneur. They built a business. It's generating, you know, $600,000 revenue. Of that is $300,000 in profit. That might not be very interesting to that entrepreneur. They may have started the business and hoped to get to millions and millions of revenue. For one reason or another, they just couldn't do it. And then they sell it to a buyer where that's really cool, where they're able to buy this cash flowing business. It does essentially operate as a lifestyle business. So that's, you know, one type of buyer. Maybe they're a VP at, you know, a tech company and they want to, you know, be CEO of a small tech company of their own. So we do a lot of those types of acquisitions, but then we work with a lot of strategic buyers where they're doing add-on acquisitions. A lot of private equity shops, there's multiple tiers to that. There's, you know, really tiny P shops that are looking for, you know, acquisitions of that size or traditional ones that are looking a little bit bigger. But yeah, the bulk of the buyers are, you know, first time buyers, experienced in tech, looking to, you know, buy a business, doing a couple hundred thousand revenue, and then, you know, potentially grow it to a couple million. And then let me get your last question. We're not seeing the Lovable wave. We're not seeing the Lovable wave just yet. I think Lovable is an awesome business and Replit too. I was actually just playing around with it before we hopped on this podcast. Same. I think the thing with those tools though, I think it's going to be a little bit, this is just my personal take on it. I think, you know, building companies, it's obviously changed in terms of how you build it. But a lot of the buyers that we work with at Acquire, they're looking for, you know, businesses with some form of product market fit. There's some paying customers. We will actually reject about 80% of the businesses that come and list with us. So we will reject businesses that don't have any revenue. If it's just been spun up, you know, in a weekend or something like that, it won't hit our marketplace. But I think in like a year, we're going to see a lot of those, you know, really good products, highly profitable. So it'll be interesting to see.
You've been pretty public about your journey, Andrew, on social and just sharing. Was there ever a time that you wish that you weren't so public about everything that you do, or has transparency just always been a key way to play?
That's another great question. You know, I would say no to that. I think just the business benefits and the personal benefits, and you know, my favorite stuff that I share is where another entrepreneur says, like, you know, I'm glad I read this, or I needed this today, something along those lines. But no, and I also enjoy posting. I love making content. I love sharing the journey and documenting it. And I would actually do this before at my previous company, but I would do it privately, where I would, you know, write in my journal, this is how June went, here's the numbers. Then I eventually turned that into a mini book. I just took all the entries and kind of expanded on them. And now I just do it publicly in real time. So no, I enjoy it.
Andrew, you're so chill about it all. I wrote in my journal a bunch of times and then turned it into a book. You know, these are like things people hope and dream to be able to accomplish, you know, as a fellow book writer myself. But no, it's interesting. I think that's something that some of even just the other founders that will listen to this show might still be struggling with, though, right? Is this putting yourself out there? Our guests don't have any problem with this, hence why they are our guests. But some of our audience does, right? Like I hear it all the time, even just from feedback from the newsletter, or, you know, founders or builders in fintech wanting to feel more comfortable with the sharing and the creating of content, not thinking that they're bragging. I'm like, you're literally never bragging. Everyone wants to hear about what you're doing. But I do think that that's something, it is interesting. You're very just like, I did it and I like it. Not everyone feels this way, right? Like it can be it can be a big blocker, but I know Drew and I are big advocates for
it goes back to making content. To what you were saying, Nicole, is like this start button. And I know, Andrew, you kind of brush it off a little bit because I'm sure it's just so deeply ingrained in you. But we are moving into this world now where there is a Lovable, there is a Replit, there is like a Bolt, and people can build multiple businesses and do it in a way and you're not getting the pressure that you used to get of like, you need to choose one lane and just run in that direction. And so going back to this like start button and you have, I'm curious to get a business off the ground. What is the most challenging part of that journey for you even today?
I mean, definitely getting the initial customers, because, you know, upfront you would, I mean, this is in the past, everything's changed this year with these AI tools, but you would spend like 6 months. Like I spent like 6 months building the first version of MicroAcquire, now Acquire. So MicroAcquire at the time. And then you just don't know if it's going to work. You're spending all this time, all this energy, you know, sometime resources to build this initial product. And, you know, after you have that initial product out, you know, people are going to say it sucks and there's all this stuff you got to fix, and it's got another 6 months to fix it. And then customers pay. So I'd say that's the hardest part. That's where you kind of start doubting yourself. Does anybody, you know, will anybody use this? Should I change it? Am I wasting my time? That sort of stuff. But I think scaling is hard too. I think it's actually all hard. That's probably a cop-out answer. But you know, once stuff starts working, like stuff starts breaking, and when you run a business, you're kind of always missing something, whether that's capital, or you need more team members, or, you know, more leads, or the leads you have are bad. Like it just never kind of ends. But Nicole, I want to circle back on what you were saying before of people, you know, maybe afraid of, you know, posting content and stuff. Whenever someone asks me like, how do I, post content? What should I do? What should my content strategy be, et cetera, et cetera. In my opinion, that's a wrong way to look at it. I think what you want to do is just ask yourself, what kind of content would I enjoy posting? Because whatever you enjoy posting, just, you know, put in your brain, no one cares what you're doing in terms of like, you know, no one's going to judge you and no one's going to think bad about you. Once you get over that, find a way to post content that you like. And then when you figure that out, you'll start to get good at it. And when you get good at it, you'll be consistent. And that's when the whole kind of flywheel starts going, in my opinion. Because you got to be consistent. If you don't enjoy it, you're not going to be consistent. If you're not consistent, you're not going to be good at it.
Right, right. Do you have a, can you show us how the sausage is made for you? I always love to hear other people's like ways of doing this. You know, I've got like my brain dump and all these things. And same thing, I have multiple like social help and people that, you know, work on my pages for me, and poor them. Cause half the time I'm like, we're running off vibes. So I don't know if I can just schedule something at 11 a.m. every day. You know, it's like there is that level of consistency. But for the most part, to your point, right, if you have to do it in a way that you actually enjoy it, then that does require like a level of flexibility, and there, it can't have too much structure. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Yeah, I agree. For me, I just wake up in the morning. I go through emails. I kind of plan out my day, and then I write a piece of content on Twitter and LinkedIn. So it's kind of that simple. I just kind of wake up, think of something that's interesting. Sometimes I'll look at my calendar the days before, just as like, here's kind of what I did.
What was I doing?
And I just don't overthink it. Like, hey, this is probably going to not be a great post or something like that. But I think it's cool. So I got a fan in myself. You know, just make content that you think is interesting or you think you would read. But it can be that simple. And I think when you overthink it and you spend too much time on it, you know, that's when you get stuck.
I'm with you. I'm with you wholeheartedly. I basically, if I want to start banging my head on the wall, I just start thinking, you know what do I like? I'm just going to do that because I like it. And that's all that matters. Exactly. A fan in yourself. Yeah. I like it, Andrew.
I think we might be finding like kind of a theme here. Like with content, if you overthink it, it just becomes so much harder. And then Drew, to your point, you know, if you overthink starting a business, like this isn't going to work, or, you know, this is hard, et cetera, et cetera, you just won't do it. So maybe that's like something I've always tried to not do, or I can do naturally. I don't know. But just, you know, for founders, I think, you know, the less you can overthink everything and just kind of put yourself out there, do it, ship it, post it. I think just the better you'll be.
Mm-hmm. Learn by doing. All right. So I do want to talk about, Andrew, before this episode, I had a great time consuming your content, by the way. And by the way, you have a fabulous video on your company website of like your team. And I was looking at it like, everybody should do this. Anyways.
Nice. Thank you.
Most startups have exits that don't make headlines. This is something you've shared before, but they do change lives. What's a story of a founder that you've helped exit that has really stayed with you?
Oh, there's a lot. There's one from last week. We helped this founder sell his business for $2 million in cash. He was 84 when it closed. Ooh. Yeah, so he's riding off into the sunset. I thought that was really, really cool. There was an acquisition we closed about a month ago where the founders were based in Spain and they sold for about $5 million. There's obviously so many more details to these acquisitions. There's ups, there's downs, there's, you know, offers that come in, they fall through. But they're based in Spain and $5 million, you know, $2 million, rough math each, that's going to completely change their lives. And the reason I say that so often is, you know, I think Silicon Valley is heavily focused on, you know, building billion-dollar companies. And, you know, these are the ones that, you know, should get all the attention. But, you know, you can do really well for yourself. And I think dramatically increase your statistical odds of being successful if you just focus on hitting a single or a double rather than a grand slam. So I see people selling their businesses like that all day long, and it is awesome. They're niche businesses. They do something really simple. They are not rocket science, you know, majors or whatever. They didn't raise a bunch of capital. I think those are great stories.
Yeah.
I would 100% agree. And I generally believe it. And I run Fiat Ventures. I run a venture fund. We invest in moonshot potential. We are power law investors. And as much as I enjoy the power law mindset, I also absolutely love these individuals that are, as you put it, going for singles and doubles. Going into some of like the psyches of some of these folks selling their businesses, what would you say the ratio is them coming to you being like, oh, I just wasn't able to quite get my business there. So this is, I'm entering this as like a hat in hand moment, potential loss, mm-hmm. versus them saying, you know, this is what we set out to do. We wanted to build a small business and sell a small business.
I think we see a mix of everything. I would say probably 50-50. 50 are, you know, we aim to build something much larger. And typically what I see, instead of like, I'm burnt out, I want to move on, it's usually, surprisingly, I've started another business. Like, I've already started working on something else. So it's one of those things where maybe it goes back to the don't overthink it, where they just started and they found a different opportunity from customers or whatever it may be, and some other business is pulling them away from the business they're looking to sell. So that could be like maybe a mixture of both. Like, I'm looking to sell it quickly, but obviously, you know, anything I can get for the business is going to help. Once you get over, you know, 1 or 2 million in revenue, in my experience, especially if you bootstrap the company, you don't have investors, that could be a pretty material life outcome for the individual. So that's where we're seeing people, you know, kind of cash on their chips. But there's always an element of like, I've taken this business as far as I can go. I'm not like an expert in marketing, or I don't want to build a big team. This is an opportunity for, you know, I'm a builder. This is an opportunity for a scaler. We see that quite a bit.
And have you guys ever looked at your marketplace and thought, maybe we should be buying some of these businesses?
All the time. Oh my gosh, it's the hardest part of the job. I always joke and say, if I wasn't running Acquire.com, I would be on Acquire.com buying different SaaS businesses. No, seriously, because I have first view into, you know, the deal flow, and I get to meet with the founders. But I think it'd be a big conflict of interest. And, you know, we love the current business we're in, but we've absolutely thought of it. I mean, me specifically.
Yeah.
Sounds like you need to make another company about the pain point of your current company, in which you would like to acquire some of the businesses that you see come through. This is another product. It's all very meta.
Yeah.
Yeah, or I could sell Acquire on Acquire, and then get into
that would get headlines.
yeah. No, but I think it'd be an interesting idea. But we're laser focused on helping founders.
Yeah, no, I love it. And like I said, I appreciate what you said before too about just and as someone who comes from the media and I've sat in newsrooms my whole career, it's, I know what's happening behind the scenes, which is, most of the time, editors are looking at what is the biggest dollar sign number that I can throw at the top of my paper, or like the top of the website, and that's what's going to get clicks. And it was a part of my pet peeve with traditional media, because it actually really limited the stories that we were telling, and it really limited the way that we shape success in our culture in general, right? Like, it doesn't have to be. So to your point, right? And the amount of times I've had, like, I feel like even I've been looked at strange if I'm not like, this is going to be a $1 billion business. Let's go. And what is so wrong with that, right? Like, I think there's something like, Andrew, I do think what you're doing, and then on top of the with Acquire, on top of like the content and the storytelling you're able to have, and like that listening of you, you can really help, and are probably already helping to reshape that narrative. Of there are multiple ways to build companies and like feel success and experience it. It doesn't have to be these like great big things. Yeah, but I imagine you feel that already.
Yeah. I mean, one way I like to put it is, you know, it really just depends on your goal as an entrepreneur. Like, you know, to Drew's point, like the moonshot bets are awesome. Like, these are reshaping industries, redefining how we work and how we do business. That is crazy. And if you could do that, more power to you. You absolutely should. But I think if a lot of entrepreneurs were just honest with themselves, like, what do I really want out of this venture? What do I want out of, you know, working 80-hour weeks and stuff like that? It's probably to create financial security and provide a better life for your family. And most of the time, a couple million bucks, or, you know, sometimes less, sometimes more, will absolutely secure that. In my opinion, that's a great time after you've secured that to go swing for the fences. But I think a lot of entrepreneurs just don't really realize that's an option, or it's almost kind of framed as like a failure, like lifestyle business is kind of like a bad thing.
I know.
But they're awesome. They're when you have a highly profitable business that is, you know, making customers happy and you have a low stress work life, I think that is killer.
Yeah. I mean, what would you say that's the biggest misconceptions founders have about getting acquired, or is there others?
I would say the biggest misconception of getting acquired is definitely like, I don't have to do anything. Like there's a saying, the best startups, yeah, surprise. There's a saying, the best startups are bought, not sold. And that's a completely accurate statement, but only for like the top 1% of the 1% businesses, like the best. They are, you know, they're at typically at scale, or they're in a super hot market. You know, for the most businesses, you just don't have a lot of inbound interest from large strategic buyers. And so I think a lot of founders just wait too long, like, oh, why hasn't Google approached me, without ever thinking like they may never approach me and I should, you know, start meeting buyers and really figuring out, you know, how can I actually make this a successful acquisition? Oh, and then valuation would be number two, you know, from the strategic acquisitions and the headlines that we do hear about. I think Datadog bought a company for like 100x revenue, or maybe 1000x revenue, something ridiculous.
Yeah.
Which is great. Shout out to those founders. You know, that is an incredible achievement. But I think that, you know, can misconstrue what other founders think their business is worth.
There's a generational transfer happening right now where, you know, 200 trillion, I don't even know what the number is, but like boomers are retiring, they're passing on. And we're seeing all these businesses transition over. And I know we're seeing it all the time. I'm sure you've been on Instagram and they say, go buy go buy vending machines, or go buy, you know, business.
Car washes.
Yeah.
Car washes. Laundry. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So are you starting to see any of the momentum from that wealth transfer inside of acquired right now?
Not specifically. Like those are mainstream businesses, and we don't list those yet. I'd like to in the future. My personal take on the big wealth transfer thing is I think it was just a little overhyped. Like I see those ads too. You know, I feel like there's such a big market pushing that narrative. You know, if you ever click on one, 9 out of 10s is going to be someone selling a course or something like that. There was like two I recently saw, but I do think in the upcoming years, 100%, I think, you know, in the next 1 or 2 years, I think we're really going to see that pick up, because we're already seeing some inbound interest. Like there's a lot of parallels between buyers looking for a cash flowing SaaS business and then, you know, surprisingly, a cash flowing, you know, service business. Yep. They generally are financing the business with SBA loans. So I think that's a really big, interesting market. It's probably the next one we'll look to help.
Ooh. Is your business today as successful as it is without SBA loans?
It is 100%. SBA loans are actually pretty hard to secure for SaaS businesses. It would be way more successful if we had our own financing product. Yes. But that's a whole other, you know, issue. And
add it to your list.
Easier said than done.
Come on, Andrew.
Yeah. I mean, it's a problem with, you know, most banks, because they don't traditionally understand the businesses as much as, say, a traditional brick and mortar business. And then there's some issues with size and location and stuff like that.
I'd say the other thing about when startups are acquired is, and I hear this kind of often, which is the culture is the first thing that can kind of get lost. What advice do you have for founders who want to protect what they've built during the handoff? I really have heard from founders in my community and that read my newsletter and have expressed to me just how painful the like handoff was selling their company.
Completely. I think the number one thing you can do is just talk to the buyer upfront, ask what their plans is post-acquisition. So you can understand, like some buyers will be upfront and say, hey, we're going to have to downsize the company, and this is what we're going to do with XYZ. We're going to roll it into a large organization. We're going to have to make some tough decisions. And that might be okay for some founders, but it might be completely not okay for others. I think just having that conversation upfront, that's what we always recommend. And I think when it is done upfront, it resolves a lot of the tension. So simple answer, just have an open, candid conversation about what to expect post-close.
Have you had to, is there any like almost horror story that you were able to like help mitigate that you're able to share?
I mean, yeah, we kind of all the time. Like there's one transaction we did really recently where the buyer was located in Japan. It was a very specific type of technology business. And there was another similar company in Japan. There was some language barriers, you know, how is, you know, the USA company going to work with Japan? And, you know, there was some tension, et cetera, et cetera. And then again, we just kind of sat everybody down and said, hey, you know, these questions are kind of coming up. How long do you expect to need the team? Who's going to run the company post-close? Is this individual expected to be CEO? Or, you know, just ironing out those issues up front, I think can really help. And if we didn't have that conversation, I don't think the transaction would have closed, because you just can't be on different pages, in my opinion, to have a good transaction.
How often are you jumping in the middle of some of these transactions? You know, at what point in these transactions are you saying, okay, we got to jump in, need some TLC from us?
I mean, all the time. You know, I love helping founders. It's actually pretty fun. And it's usually a pretty smooth process. It's usually, but there's always like the situations where, you know, things don't go as planned, or an offer is starting to fall through, or the buyer's going silent, or, you know, that's where I'll step in to help. But the majority of our transactions are touchless, where we're initially helping them at the beginning. We're prepping them on the marketplace, coaching them to meet with buyers. And then we build tools that essentially productizes the whole M&A experience. But someone emails me, or if I know that I can help in some way, I'll set up a call and see what I can do.
So how many startups do you have on the platform now? Like today, July 1st, 2025.
I think it's like 1,200 last I looked.
Okay. All right. So you got like 1,200. You got 1,200 children over there that you're like watching over, essentially. Yeah, are you that hands-on? Are you that hands-on, Andrew? Like,
I see everyone, you know, list and go live. You know, we have, you know, different Slack rooms where I'm seeing they just submitted and they just got approved and this one has a question. So I see pretty much most of it, if not all, but I don't have every detail on them. But out of the 1,200, we'll sell, you know, a few hundred per month. And then each month we're taking another 200 live. So it's a very active marketplace.
From a supply and demand standpoint on the marketplace side, how many investors, potential investors, do you need to have in comparison to companies listed?
We would probably say that we are supply constrained, where good businesses always go really, really fast. They usually see multiple different offers from multiple different buyers. One transaction closed within 2 weeks, which I thought was pretty crazy. It was, I think, for like 1.4 million. This was 2 weekends ago. Wow. It went live on the marketplace on Thursday, received a LOI on Friday. They signed the APA on Saturday. So we're really not even involved. Just buyers are, you know, specifically looking for, you know, cash flowing SaaS businesses, exactly what they're looking for, and then moves in escrow and closes. That's not always the case. But if we just had a surplus of high quality, profitable businesses, you know, things would just explode. So if you have a good quality business, we can almost always find a buyer. I shouldn't say always, but more often than not.
Yeah.
You can have that kind of conviction. It is seemingly always, Andrew. You've seen the rise of the micro acquisitions, the indie startup getting these life-changing exits. And it is one of those things where I don't think we're always thinking about the humans behind it, right? Which, like you said, right, it can be like the 84-year-old just getting that money that then they ride off into the sunset, or that you know, that person in Spain where $2 to $3 million is really life-changing. What maybe excites you most about where this is heading, like what you're building? Is it like, I hate to make the joke about, and you've probably heard this, like, have you thought about acquired getting acquired? And then what happens after that, right? It's like, or what is just like the most exciting for you in terms of like where this is all going?
Yeah, great question. I think, I mean, for now, I'm still just having a lot of fun. I think it's one of the most rewarding jobs I could have asked for. So I love what I do. For the foreseeable future, I'd love to keep running the company. One thing that really excites me about the future, though, is the rise of like the solopreneur with these tools that can just make, you know, a team of one, two people extremely, extremely efficient and build highly profitable companies. I think that's, it's going to go in an interesting direction. I think there's some headwinds that we could really help with. Like one thing I think about often is, you know, in venture, you would typically attack, you know, or not typically, but always attack really big market opportunities because you want to build a really big business. And so it just didn't make sense to build really small niche businesses where the use case and the pain points are still there. It's too much to, you know, serve that market opportunity. So I think, you know, as an example, I think people can make a CRM for, you know, obituaries and stuff like that, like the most weird niche industries. And there's still really big markets there, you know, maybe not big in terms of billions, but, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions in revenue. So I could see a world where there's just a lot more entrepreneurs. And I think Acquire could really, really thrive in that environment. So we'll see.
Right. Well, because you've mentioned before, right, there is this like level of what could be almost like a graduation program, if you will, right? Like you start small. It's one of our mottos here at Fintech is Fun, which is start small, scale fast, dream big, right? So like you start small and sell your 2 to 3 million, right, on acquire.com, followed by the next startup and then the next startup and the next startup. Like, have you seen any of those? You have, right? You said that earlier, I swear.
Yeah.
Like the graduating, yeah, if you will. But and that is something that could kind of happen through the solopreneur, which I do feel like we are seeing the rise of, and I'm seeing even more fintech products out there designed for the solopreneur. I mean, what would you say then to, let's say we have a solopreneur who is starting to feel the pressure to raise VC money? How can they know if bootstrapping and a strategic exit is actually the better path for them?
I think it comes back to their goals. They want to transform a market. I would just, you know, one caveat there. I don't think raising capital is in any sense bad. I think just the goal should be to have a clear use for the capital. For example, if you're acquiring customers for $5 and they're worth, you know, 50, and you're just sitting there saying, hey, I wish I had, you know, a few extra million to just pour gasoline on this fire, that makes a ton of sense. I think you should absolutely do that. But a lot of businesses don't have that growth lever. So I think if you have a clear use of capital, you're honest with yourself about your goals, because when you're raising capital and let's say you're at an inflection point, you have product market fit, you have a few hundred million in revenue, something like that. Things are just starting to really take off and it's a business. You know, if you don't raise capital, you could sell that business for several million in a year or 2 years. I'm generalizing a lot right here, but you know, those two paths are going to be completely different, but, you know, for that entrepreneur, they could be signing up for a decade in the same business, potentially end up with nothing or like $1 billion, or they can head down the same path that they're currently on, and be pretty wealthy and not have any debt, buy your house cash, sail out in the sunset, or start another business. So I think just thinking through that, is extremely important, because I think the way you finance your business is one of the biggest decisions in an entrepreneur's career. And there's no going back.
That is so true. It is. And you know what you're reminding me of is that, I think it was Oprah that said that the biggest difference with like successful people and not is that they know where they want to go, right? Like there's,
yeah,
right? They have their goals. They actually know where they're heading or intend on heading. And I do think that can be like a moment, if you will, and a level of reflection that any founder needs to have, right? And I think that actually kind of goes back to like, do you still journal today, or is LinkedIn your journal?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, it's yep. How you've been journaling your whole life?
Not my whole life. I think I started a little after college. It was when I started. It's not my first startup, but the first one that like was kind of taken off. I was super young at the time, and I knew it was kind of weird. You know, I'm 21, I'm managing these people. So I started a journal to kind of write that down.
Nice.
What are these? Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. What from your journal can you share? Like at that time where you're like, you're 21, you're so funny. You're like, this was not my first business, but my first real business. Uh-huh. Right. What were some of those like Andrew at 21 reflections, maybe that you look back on now and you're like, that I'm so much better now, right? As a grown up, or like, I've learned so much since then. Or yeah. Do you ever look back at those?
All the time. Yeah. I mean, when I write my journal, I can just scroll down and I see the entries. Let me think. I think like getting an office was really weird for me. I started the business when I was 21. You know, I was managing, let's call it a few dozen people at like 22, 23. And just that whole experience was just really weird for me because I didn't really have a traditional job before that. Didn't have any sales experience or product experience or marketing experience. And then during that time, the mobile market was just absolutely, it was just exploding. It was just right fit, right time. You had extremely strong product market fit. So I think just that whole experience like was just surreal. It was a ton of fun, super grateful for it. But yeah, we had like a cool office and I got to like paint graffiti the walls however I wanted. We had to pick out the carpets, just dumb stuff like that.
Wow. Yeah. Cool. Andrew was like, with 21-year-old Andrew with his coffee was like, and today, this morning, I got to pick out just the right paint and rugs for my brand new office that is so strange to have. How am I 22 managing a team?
Think of it this way. Think of it this way. So growing up, I always wanted to be like CEO of a company. And then I actually became CEO of a company. Like it just kind of happened. And so it's kind of like a parallel would be like, you grow up wanting to be the quarterback of Patriots or, you know, the Niners or something like that. And then you're really the quarterback. So I kind of had a lot of those like, oh, it's so cool. I get to pick out the carpet. This is so cool. And it's kind of dumb. But to me, it was the coolest thing ever.
No, not at all.
No, that is cool. I actually think you wouldn't really know to look. I think what you're showing us is that something that a lot of people miss, right? Which is the like appreciation of those moments. And I think any founder or entrepreneur, myself included, I'm really bad at that, right? Like, I wasn't even sure. I remember when my book launch was coming out and I was like, I'm like overly stressed about it that I don't even want to throw a party and my business partner and life partner is like, of course we're throwing a party. What are you talking about? You wrote a book, right? This is like a dream come true. But this is what happens, right? You like, I'm like, but does anyone care? And it's like, we care. So just go out, you know what I mean? But that, I think that a lot of founders listening to this would really resonate with that, which is like not knowing when to have that, like, holy shit, I've done it. Remember when I said I wanted to do it and here I am, I've done it, because we're so busy with the next, thinking of like the next thing or not putting that appreciation.
I'll share why I started journaling. First just started like for fun, just kind of write things down. But I would write what's going well and then what's going wrong. And then, you know, a few things I'm grateful for at the bottom. But what I found after writing what's going wrong in the business, each month I would check back on whatever is going wrong. It'd be XYZ hire isn't working out. Like we lost his customers, blah, blah, blah. I'd be super stressed out about it. Like in the moment, it felt like the worst things ever happening. And I noticed every single month I'd check back and be like, oh, that thing? Oh, we fixed it. Like it's not even a problem. Now I have these problems. I think once I started getting that perspective, like whatever problems I have today, I'm not going to be so stressed out about it in a month. So why should I be stressed about it today? So that was a good exercise. And then also just writing about like what you're grateful for, I think just puts you in a better mood and gives you even more perspective on, you know, you probably have it pretty good. It's not all bad because entrepreneurship can be so stressful. I think those little things have helped me.
I love that. Oh my gosh. This is our journaling show. No one has talked about this, like, and how important that level of like reflection. And it's true though. You can really like see the patterns. So everyone has to journal now, not just LinkedIn journals. We need yeah. Are you a handwriter? No, we're using.
I use Penzu.
Wait, what's that?
Penzu.
It's Penzu.com. I don't know. They've been asking me to upgrade from their free account for a decade now. So haven't got me yet.
Oh, man. All right. We're going to have to look at this is like a journal hack to.
Yeah, I'm going to check it out.
Stack.
Oh, it's cool because it gives you these reminders. So I'll get a, hey, 8 years ago, you wrote this, which I think is the coolest feature because it like takes you back. Cool. And that's also a reason why, you know, I'll write stuff down because I'll be like, oh, 5 years from now, I'm going to look at this and be like, so yeah, check it out.
Okay. All right. Life hack. We're all journaling now. I really could do this, which is hilarious because I'm a writer. Anyways. All right. We have just a few minutes left. Let's see. Before we jump into rapid fire, Andrew, I would love to ask one more question, really, which is, for the founders who worry that selling means giving up, what is your perspective on that mindset?
I think it just depends on where you are. I mean, you do get paid for giving up. I think that's a good part of selling, and for anyone that thinks that. But if you feel like you still have more gas in the tank, I think you should keep going for it, because you only get so many shots with building a company. And if you're a couple years in, or 3 years in, 4 years in, and maybe you just hit a bump, I would reflect on, you know, can you get past that, or do you even want to get past it? And if not, that's a good time to sell. But if you have gas in the tank, keep going. But in terms of like people thinking you're a sellout or giving up or something like that, I would never worry about what someone else thinks. And eventually every business needs to be sold. Every, you know, person that starts a company eventually needs to shut it down, pass it down to someone, or exit the business. So it's just a matter of figuring out if now's the right time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. We're going to do some rapid fire questions, Andrew, to close out. I'm going to ask the first few, and then Drew's going to pick up the rest. First thing that comes to mind, Andrew, and frankly, you've been doing this whole show, so I'm not even worried about you. You're pretty, okay. You're pretty quick. So okay. Let's see how quick you are here. Luckily, everything's edited, so it doesn't actually matter. All right. Question one. What is the first app you check every morning?
Probably Gmail.
It's mine. I almost want to also ask, what is the first thing you do every morning?
Get coffee.
I'm like, where's the journal plug? And then, when do you journal? Do you journal after the coffee? Like when?
So it's not every day. It's usually like once a month or every other month. And that's kind of random. Whenever I'm like, oh, this is a good time to write like 10 lines about how things are going.
Got it. Done. Okay. One piece of startup advice that you think is total bullshit.
Something along the lines of like raising money. You know, I think that advice just, it's so loud in terms of what every entrepreneur thinks. I think a lot of entrepreneurs think, get into YC, raise a seed round, get into TechCrunch, you're successful, rather than just like fundamental business. So something along those lines.
Yes. I think that the path of success is, there are many of them, right? There's dozens and dozens of them, and not just the one that you laid out. So, a moment where you almost quit. What kept you going?
I got a crazy story. So the mobile app business I built, we developed so many apps that Apple actually froze all of our publishing abilities, which meant at one point we were trying to publish thousands of apps and they said, nope. I thought the business was going to get shut down. Essentially, we'd just not be able to operate. Ended up sending this, you know, Hail Mary cold email to Tim Cook one night. And he sent it over to this guy, Phil Schiller. He responded back. I met with him on Monday. This was a Saturday night. But during that time, I lost like 10 pounds. It's crazy. So many clients were like calling me, pissed off. You know, I can't update my app. This doesn't work. And we were just sitting there with our hands tied. So that was hard. I'd say maybe a couple of days, but we figured it out.
What a scary moment.
Wow.
It was. I thought I lost everything.
But you did get a response from Tim Cook. So that's pretty cool.
They changed the guideline. It's a longer story, but that time.
Anyways, well, the cold email works, people. That's what we're getting at. All right. Last question on my end before Drew jumps in. The most underrated skill a founder can have.
I think sales. I would say sales.
Distribution all the way. It's a tough moat to beat in this market. I got a couple more for you. A book podcast, a book or podcast you'd recommend to every founder thinking about selling their business?
Oh, that's a good one. I'd say Strategic Entrepreneurship. It's a book by this guy, John Fisher. It's an interesting perspective on just entrepreneurship and how acquisitions can actually play into an entrepreneur's career. Basically, John Fisher, he's built like 10 different businesses, and he views building businesses as almost like creating a small puzzle piece to fit into a larger puzzle. I think that book is great. It's a short read too.
Great. Yeah. I haven't heard that one. I'm excited to lean into that. What's a hill you would absolutely die on when it comes to building companies?
Distribution is more important than product.
Speaking my language, dude. Agree.
Spicy takes.
I was just going to say, I mean, you got to have a great product, obviously, but without distribution, I think it all falls apart. And I do think distribution is how you build a great product. You have to get it in front of customers. Customers give you feedback. So yeah, distribution of a product.
What's your go-to hype song?
Back to Back by Drake. I think I played way too much. I'm going to go with that. Back to Back by Drake.
Wow.
Can't go wrong with Drake. And last question. Finish the sentence. The smartest founders I know always
sell, market their business every single day. It's the first thing that came to mind. Distribution.
Distribution. Distribution.
Wow. Look at Andrew Gazecki saying that the best founders always sell their companies.
That's true. I love it. Traditional sales, but
of course.
Yes.
Oh.
Sell the company as well.
That too. I know. Yeah. No, I love it. It is true. It's incredible advice. And thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us on FinTech Mavericks and sharing all of your wisdom. Particularly, I'm mostly also fascinated around the journaling. I, for one, look forward to that. If anyone listening to this actually starts journaling after this show, you have to tell me about it. I need feedback if that's like a thing that happens, because that would be really amazing. Anyways, thank you, Andrew, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And I will say, check out acquire.com. I've signed up and perused. Even if you're not looking to buy, it's very fun to go in there and just see what's happening.
Thanks for the plug, Drew. Appreciate that. Yeah, go to Acquire. Thanks, you guys. Appreciate it.